welcome to another episode of the Hamden Library Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Pieri. This month, we are recognizing Native American Heritage Month with two interviews. Ryan spoke to David Eichelberg, a member of the Mohegan tribe who specializes in outreach and is also doing a program with the library later this month. Check our website for more details about that. Ariana talked with Matthew Macamino, enrolled member of the Grand Traverse Bay Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians, assistant dean of Yale College, and director of Yale's Native American Cultural Center. What I like about these interviews is that, although they touch upon tradition, they also discuss the contemporary life of Indigenous people. Popular media, as well as history books, have tended towards stereotyping Native peoples. And while that seems to be changing for the better, as evidenced by the recent popularity of shows like Reservation Dogs, it's still a too rare privilege to get to hear from Indigenous people themselves in their own words. So please listen, enjoy this episode, and hopefully, like me, you'll learn something you didn't know before.
Joining us today is David Eichelberg. He is the Outreach and Traditions Specialist for the Mohegan Tribe. Hi, David. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really well. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you so much for joining us. And the first thing that I want to have you do is just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do.
Yeah, so my name is David Eichelberg, Natiawis Patakam Wasus. My name is Thunderbear. That's my tribal given name given to me by my grandfather, Carlton Eichelberg. And as the Outreach and Tradition Specialist for the Mohegan Tribe, I go from school to school or to businesses, any group that might be looking for a program to learn about Mohegan culture and Native American culture from the Eastern Woodland area. So I do schools, elderly homes, businesses, anyone who's looking for some kind of program, which is pretty cool because that diversifies the people I'm talking to, whether it's third graders, whether it's college kids or even adults, because the adults really love the history part, where the kids really love the hands-on, looking at all the cool, intricate stuff, the pieces that I like to bring along with me. So, it's a little bit about what I do here.
Excellent. And, I think a lot of people probably learned what they know about Native American culture in elementary school or a long time ago. So I wanted to have you give a little bit of background and history of the Mohegan tribe.
Yeah. So the Mohegan tribe was actually founded in the 1630s. What happened was before that, our tribal nation was actually a part of the Pequot tribe of Stonington, Connecticut. And due to some political differences, the Mohegan people split off. The first chief, Uncas, he took his loyal followers and created the Mohegan village over about 7 miles away from the Pequot village and right on Fort Shantock, where we still have our sacred burial grounds today, created our first fort and village of the Mohegan people in the 1630s. Which is pretty shortly after the landings at Plymouth and when the Europeans started getting pretty predominant here on the northeast coast of what is now the United States. So that's kind of where our beginnings start. Now, we do have some teachings that go back even further, that we traveled from New York, that we originally come from the Lenni Lenape tribal nation of the Delaware, New Jersey area. But that is much farther in our tribal history. So what we have written in documents from the Europeans and what is written in stone really comes from, the Pequot tribe and living with our, Narragansett family and our other tribal nations in this area before the Europeans came here. But that's a little bit of the history from, how we were created. Our tribal name is Mohegan, which translates to the word wolf. We were the Mohicans, the wolf people. So we wanted to use that name because when we were part of the Lenni Lenape tribal nation, we actually were the wolf clan of that tribal nation. So when we moved from living with them in Delaware, we wanted to adorn that name again once we separated ourselves from the Pequot tribe.
That is that's great. A lot of times when I do these interviews, I kind of know what the speaker is going to tell me, and I'm getting a totally new education here from you. So I really appreciate it. And the next thing actually that I learned from looking into you when I was reaching out to you was the museum, the Tantaquidgeon Museum. And I'd love to hear some about that.
Yeah. So I got a you know, shout out that it's the oldest native owned and operated museum in the, I believe in all of North America, if not just the United States. Tribal citizens built it in 1931. I believe it's Gladys Tantaquidgeon, who was our medicine woman in the 1900s. Her, along with her brother Harold, and along with their father John Tantaquidgeon, all built that museum together. John Tantaquidgeon was a stonemason. However, at this time, he was pretty old. He was pretty handicapped. So he did all the smart building, and then his two kids, Harold and Gladys, kind of did all the manual labor. So they built the museum out of stone. The original stonework still there today, and it's housed some of the oldest pieces that has been found in the United States. We actually have in our possession at the museum the oldest piece of wampum that has been recorded on in North America. It's over 400 years old, which is really, really cool to have that. And that was a possession from Uncas himself. It was a necklace or an armband or a choker that he actually wore during his life. So it's pretty cool to have that piece of history. But it is a free museum, always free. They have hours throughout the week. We're trying to get more hours in the weekend to, you know, offer more family time, because, you know, when kids are in school, that's kind of hard to go during the week. But the museum's really cool. We have hundreds of baskets from all over Indian country that have either been donated to us or that Gladys was able to either trade for or given as gifts through her travels through North America during the early 1900s or mid 1900s. And then we also have some modern pieces in there as well, because, you know, a lot of our pieces don't hold up. Pieces of wood won't last long if it's buried underground. Our corn husk dolls, we don't have those from hundreds of years ago. So we have a lot of recreations to kind of show what the artistic ability was like back then. With our corn husk doll, our corn cob pieces, our wooden pieces, our bowls. And then we have just some pieces from 1800s and 1900s as well. Pieces from our medicine woman, Emma Baker, who was our medicine woman in the 1840s to like the 1870s. We have regalia from some of our 20th century chiefs, like Lemuel Fielding, who was chief from 1903 to 1928. We have his beadwork, which is heavily kind of patriotically based. He has the American flag on it. The beadwork is very intricate, very beautiful. So it has some really cool pieces. And then we also have, along with hundreds of other pieces, we also have quilts that were actually made inside of our church by our Women's Sewing Society. That's a very important part for us, because our church, which is just down the street from our museum, women used to meet there to pass on culture during a time where culture wasn't allowed to be taught or allowed to be shown in public. So teaching that culture and the stories that they shared is basically everything of what I'm talking with you today about. So because of those women, you know, quilting during their Women's Sewing Society and then teaching all these stories and passing down language, we have a culture today because of those women back then. So the museum's pretty cool. It is open from 10 to 3, Tuesday through Friday. And then I believe we're looking to have more Saturday hours coming very, very shortly.
Excellent. That's good to know. And that kind of leads into the next topic. One of the things that you have on your website is the Mohegan story. And it'd be cool to hear a little bit about that as well.
Yeah. So I kind of already touched a little bit of it, but the Mohegan story starts with us being part of the Lenni Lenape tribal nation of Delaware. The Wolf Clan, there's three clans that make up that Lenni Lenape tribe we come from, the turkeys, the turtles, and the wolf. The wolf want to move away and kind of create their own tribal identity. And so the wolf people move all the way to upper state New York, up by the Great Lakes. They live there for, you know, a couple hundred years, but they realize they kind of want to keep moving. They hear of great fishing lands and great deer hunting grounds out east. And so they go in search of this better place to live. And they come across, you know, Stonington, Connecticut, which is what we refer to as now. But that's where the Pequot tribe comes in. When the Wolf Clan moves into here, they are known as the Pequotogs, which means invaders, because to other native people, you know, the wolf people came in and kind of pushed some tribes out, a little bit out west, a little bit out east. Some tribes kind of moved in and out of the area, and the Pequots really took a hold of this area, you know, from Stonington, kind of close to what is now Hartford, and that Pequot tribe owned a lot of what is now southeastern Connecticut. After many years of living there, even Uncas's grandfather, who Uncas was born in 1598, even Uncas's grandfather hunted in our woods today at Fort Shantock. So we do have hundreds of years of history that go back to like the 1400s about living in this area. So we do have some of that knowledge as well. But like I said, in the 1630s, what is now the Mohegan people, led by Uncas, Uncas is displeased with who becomes the new chief of the Pequot Nation. He wanted the power. He wanted his ideology to kind of come to fruition. And so he has several different political differences with the new chief of the Pequot tribe. And he kind of gets kicked out of the Pequot Nation. And so after he's kicked out several times, he takes his loyal followers and creates his own tribe in Uncasville, Connecticut. And Uncas leads us until his death in 1685, sorry. And so he lives a pretty long life, and he adapts very, very quickly, which is kind of how we have survived this long. You know, the second the English land here, he's trying to be friends with them. He's trading, he's getting rifles, he's getting pieces of metal, he's learning the language very quickly. Uncas even has kids with English names. He names three of his kids Ben Uncas. So even very quickly, he adapts to this European mindset, because he knew that would be ending up saving us in the long run. So when it comes to always working with the English or working with the American government after the revolution, there's this long history of, oh, we've always been working friendly together. We've worked with you. Like, we're your friends. We don't need to be kicked out or, you know, attacked by the U.S. cavalry. And so that really helps protect us for many, many years. And then also keeping us from having to join the Trail of Tears out west. Our tribe was susceptible to that as well. But because we built a church and we showed that we were quote unquote civilized, that's a big piece on why we were allowed to stay in our most recent homelands, which is very nice to be able to stay in, you know, our last piece of land that we lived in before the Europeans came to these shores.
That's an incredible story. And now that we really kind of filled the history there over the last couple topics, and now I wanted to ask what contemporary Mohegan community life is like.
Contemporary Mohegan life is different from most tribes. Most tribes really have that tribal community still to this day. You know, when they kind of live all close together, they get to see each other, they get to have events, they have, you know, ceremony or whatever, what have you. But ours is very different. Very early on, our villages, like we didn't live in villages anymore. We weren't living in longhouses. In the 1720s, our last Mohegan children were being born in wigwams. And like Samson Mockum, who was a minister for the Mohegan people for a while, and he has a whole huge story as well. He was one of the last men to be born in a wigwam. So, you know, we were living in houses. We weren't living in a village with all of our family anymore. We were living with our community members. We had our own houses and kind of living among Europeans coming in. So over hundreds of years of that kind of lifestyle, we have separated from that community aspect. Now, we do have plenty of community here. It's just that we live in neighboring towns, you know, like Stonington, Ledyard, Moosup. We all live within kind of like an hour of this place. But we also have members living all over the world, you know, New York, California. We have some living in Korea because we have a business venture going on over there. So our membership does truly live in all parts of the world. But our community is really strong for those that do live in the area. You know, we have our socials that we invite not only Mohegan people to, but also other tribal nations as well. We have our wigwam festivals, our language classes, and we do have a pretty close-knit community. It's just a little bit, it's not as community-based as other tribes may be in the modern times. But we still are speaking the language. We have a great language program going through our language department, and we are, you know, we are teaching people the modern language, as we kind of call it, because our language has adapted over many, many years of trying to, you know, read old scriptures and old books and old notes about our language. And it's hard to have that when we haven't had a fluent speaker since the early 1900s. But that's kind of where our tribe is today. We modernize very quickly. And so we kind of lost that kind of traditional lifestyle very early on. And then also with losing our culture, you know, with like most tribal nations, we are always rebuilding. We're rebuilding the stories. We're rebuilding the traditions that our, you know, our ancestors faced a long time ago. But that's kind of where we are today.
And I also wanted to let people know that you are going to be here at the library on Tuesday, November 21st in Thornton Wilder Hall for the Mohegan Cultural Program. And that'll be from 5 to 6 p.m.
So, yeah, I'm looking forward to coming to the library to give a talk. It should be a fun time, filled with drum songs, teaching, some culture, some tradition, you know, a little question and answer time. And maybe even some traditional dances as well. So that should be a very fun program.
Yeah, for sure. And people can visit your website as well. David, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been great.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was a privilege. You know, working with our museums are very important as the keepers of history. And so we like to give back to our libraries and try to give them, you know, the most up-to-date teachings that we have and just offer them programs because they deserve it.
Excellent. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much.
Hello. My name is Ariana Davis, and I work as a library page here at Hampton Public Library. I also have the privilege of being a contributor for our Hampton Public Library podcast. Matthew McElmanaw, Grand Traverse Bay Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians, is the Assistant Dean of Yale College and Director of the Native American Cultural Center. Matthew earned 3 degrees from Michigan State University, his Bachelor of Arts in Psychology, his Master of Arts in Higher Adult and Lifelong Education Student Affairs, and his PhD in Higher Adult and Lifelong Education. His dissertation focused on tribal college transfer student success at 4-year institutions. Over the course of his career, he has created and supported programs to help Native and Indigenous students make the transition to and thrive in college, including summer bridge programs, college access initiatives, powwows, tribal outreach, and student retention and success. Thank you so much, Dr. McElmanaw, for joining me today. Well, firstly, I would like to ask if you can please share with our listeners your story, your journey of embracing your heritage and connecting personally with your Native nation and tribe.
Yeah, thank you. Hello, everyone. Matthew McElmanaw, Nadish Nakaz, Michigan Dorum, Grand Traverse Bay Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians. I'm also a Little Traverse Bay Band of Ottawa Indians on my mom's side. I grew up in Haslett, Michigan, which is a suburb of Lansing, in an urban area. I didn't grow up on the reservation, but I grew up with lots of family. My grandparents had 12 children, which means I had lots of cousins. Family gatherings were, you know, like 60, 70 of us, you know, for the different holidays and camping. And in the Lansing, we also had the Lansing Indian Center, Urban Area Center, and getting to know other Indigenous students in the area. And so a lifelong resident of Michigan, and then, you know, I left Michigan maybe 12 years ago, and I've been out in Montana, Utah, Colorado, and now here in Connecticut. And so I have been very excited. I've always worked in Native education, working for Native communities. And it's something, you know, I probably got from my mother, who, you know, has going to her work, and she always worked with Native communities and Native organizations. And so it was always something that was really important to me to be able to support Indigenous students. And I think as I think about it, it's you know, I have really two big things that really drive me is college access and career development. And I think about those two things were important to me because I think those are things that I, you know, struggle with at different times in terms of finding a college and having support and what does it mean to go to college and how do I apply and how do I take advantage of the different resources? And then, you know, moving on to finding out how do I find a job once I'm in college and how do I find a career? And so I think those are two really things I you know, I have found my role that have been my purpose in life. And it was a lifelong journey to figure that out. And but I really enjoy it. And I've built my career upon it. And I've been very happy doing that. Mm.
Thank you for highlighting your background to how that also motivated you to focus on a career path that also encourages Native and Indigenous students as well in pursuing education. Were there any particular challenges that you would like to expand on that you faced on your academic and professional journey?
Yeah, I'm happy to kind of go over that. I think there's, you know, there's quite a few in everybody's story, right, of their pursuit and education and challenges, whether that's invisibility of Indigenous people in the curriculum, right, in K-12 or even in higher education sometimes, to stereotypes, right? And so either not being seen or being seen but having different stereotypes, I think are different challenges that I have faced, but that also Indigenous students have faced, and figuring out how to overcome those. As somebody, you know, in your youth, how do I address that? How do I make it through that? How does this incident impact me, right? Whether that's, like I said, stereotypes from mascots to generalizations in curriculum that may be inaccurate or inaccuracies, you know, within curriculum. And so I think that challenge is something that all Indigenous students face. And I think the more that we can have mentors and people sharing their stories and talking and guiding Native youth, you know, that'll be really helpful for Native success. And, you know, when I teach class, I often talk about, and I ask one of my assignments, and I ask people to go and Google, right, or whatever your search engine is, go to your search engine and type in, you know, Native American student success. And what you're going to find is 80 to 90% of the top 10 answers there are going to be Native failure, Native dropout, right? It's not going to be Native success. So there's a lot of stories out there about Native people not belonging in education or not fitting in education or failing in education. And you have all these perspectives out there and mindsets. And if you're taking that in as an Indigenous person, right, you might have feelings that maybe I don't belong. Maybe I'm not good enough, right? And so I think it's really important to highlight success and to highlight Native people out there who are succeeding in the communities out there that want their Native youth to succeed, right? And so there's a long list of people out there for Native youth that want them to succeed and want them to thrive. And so I think highlighting those and sharing those stories and sharing how to overcome those challenges and talking about Native values and perspectives and empowering our students to kind of overcome those various obstacles, I think is really important. It's something I've committed my life work to doing and will continue to do and try to understand and to motivate and be as good of a mentor as I can towards that.
Thank you for considering that question in detail. And it's a perfect segue into my next question, those principles that guide your teaching and mentorship. How have you been able to expound upon that in your work with the Native American Cultural Center? And also if you'd like to share any history in regard to the center as well.
Yeah, thank you. And I think it's an ongoing thing, right? And I think as we talk about a lifelong learner and constantly evolving and thinking about how you can continue to learn and how to continue to be a mentor and to people. And I think that's something I'm certainly always a student of and trying to be better. And lately, you know, I've really been thinking about values and Native values and what does that mean for myself and how do I approach people and approach students, right? And thinking about those core values. And again, with Native students, we talk about in a very general, right? It may sound like monolithic, but really, you know, Native people or, you know, federally recognized tribes are over 570. They're state recognized tribes. And there's different cultures and traditions and languages. And so there's not like a singular Native American experience or student. And I think that's important to know and to, you know, really work, especially here where I work at Yale, you know, as opposed to, say, I was working in Michigan, for the most part, you know, 80-90% of the students I'm working with might identify as Anishinaabe, right? But here at Yale, it's across the nation and then the world, really. And so Indigenous people, we don't really have a group of students who are large, meet a large number. So we're really working with diversity of Indigenous students is really what we're doing here. And, you know, really approaching that, you know, and I think what I do is just try to approach and be who I am and to be myself. And I think people will say that a lot. And it's a real difficult thing to do, right? To be that authentic you in the world where, you know, constantly challenged and obstacles and really figure out, you know, what drives you. Who are you and how does that reflect and how does that kind of leader you want to be? And so I'm constantly trying to learn from others and think about how do I do that and how do I lead and work with students, right, who are also growing and doing the same thing. And so something that we try to do, and it's something we definitely do at the Native American Culture Center, where we're very focused on and what does the center mean to the individual and why is it important to you and why are you here? Why do you come to the center? And thinking about that, and that's how we want to make sure we create that environment for others too, right? So if it's important to me because I feel like I'm comfortable and this is a space where I can be myself, right? Like we want to make sure we reflect that for everybody so that they can also come and be themselves, right? And so that we're creating this thing that we all really remembering, you know, why is it here? What's our purpose? And it's something that we're always constantly, or at least I'm constantly thinking about, what's the purpose? What are we trying to do? What am I trying to do? What's the center supposed to be? And I think thinking about that and coming that from that, we're in a really, you know, solid value and good space is something we're constantly trying to do and create programs that reflect that. And again, like I said, the diversity of the different cultures and bringing in different speakers from different aspects of indigeneity and really trying to share those voices, but then also learn from each other and to understand different perspectives. And like I said, there's diversity in Native culture, so there's a lot to learn from each other's and each other's background as well. And so we're really just trying to create this visibility on campus of Indigenous peoples and that we're community of culture, but we're also a community of scholars. And we want to create that and make that visible, right? It's not just sometimes when we think about Indigenous people, we think the pre like 1800s vision of what Native people, they often think of Indigenous people, but we also want to make sure that, that people realize that we're also culture, but we're also, you know, we can be talking about in history, but there's all other places. There are Indigenous engineers, there's an Indigenous scientists, mathematicians, and or Indigenous scholars. And so that's something that we do at the center and try to really bring a value-based visibility, a place where people feel comfortable and create a community, right? That, that we are a community, that we support each other, and that, that's our aim.
Thank you for sharing that. It really helps us to see the importance of shedding any stigma. And I like the saying that you said of, you know, not only looking at culture, but it's a community of culture, but a community also of scholars. So thank you. So kind of looking at your background and experience and degree in education, in your opinion, what improvements can be made to the curricula and teaching of Native American and Indigenous history in primary and secondary educational settings?
Yeah, I'll try to do my best. Right, like I said, these are big questions with a lot of answers and a lot of ways to answer those. I'll try to answer it in some very, very general ones that kind of come to mind. But like I said, there's a lot within that kind of context. From right, certainly trying to address any stereotypes that might exist in different curriculum to, like I said, again, the visibility of that Indigenous people are modern people, right? We're not historical, right? We're a contemporary living culture and people that is here today and it has kind of grown, and we're not just something of the past, right? And I think that's important too. I think if we think about curriculum, it talks about Native people often in history, in the historical lens, as if something that no longer exists, right? And so really thinking about how to bring Indigenous people into context, whether it, again, as I said before, we're engineers, we're scientists, we're literary, right? Like if you're in English class, there are Native poets, there are Native authors, you know, there are Native examples and Indigenous people that we can bring in, or professionals as well. And right, and it's not just for Native people, but it's also for people who are non-Native as well to understand that there are Native scholars out there as well, and that there's knowledge that they can learn from. And that that knowledge, Indigenous knowledge, is also valuable and is also has informed not only historically but also in contemporary times as well and is of place. So I think that's one area of, I guess, improvement as well. I think also thinking about it. So I think that's one part. I think, like I said, addressing the stereotypes. And again, I have two children who are now in sixth grade and ninth grade, and even going through some of their elementary and homework and things that kind of came home with them, and having to talk to teachers. So there's still a lot of stereotypes that happens. And I think some of the challenge is, and again, it's really tough in the curriculum because sometimes you might say, hey, you have to talk about Native people in this land or this time period. And so a teacher may get that, but they don't necessarily always get how to teach it. It's just, I have to talk about it. And then how it happens individually, we don't know what happens, right? Sometimes it doesn't, sometimes it might not go in a good way. And so really figuring out how do we teach the teachers too, right? And so that's more of higher education. And then the teaching curriculum is understanding and how do we teach teachers who are going to be working with students, because there won't always be Indigenous people to be able to be teachers or to talk about Indigenous perspectives. There'll also be people who are non-Native. So how do we think about approaching teaching teachers, and how do we incorporate that, and especially for something that for some curriculum might only be a two-week lesson plan, right? And so how do we change the curriculum and infuse curriculum into where Indigenous peoples is within that system? It's a big challenge, and it'll take a lot of work. I don't have the answers here right now how that is, other than to say that I think that's a really important part of it, is the curriculum of how to reproducing teachers, and what are we talking to them about, how to talk about Indigenous history, culture, language, and people. And certainly starting locally and starting with the state, within the state of wherever that may be, in here in Connecticut, learning about the Indigenous people here.
Thank you for considering that question and providing that educational perspective on the history of Native Americans and Indigenous people, as well as that living heritage. My last question is, how can organizations and members of the community continue to recognize and support Native Americans and Indigenous people?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there's a couple parts, right? And I think one is for individuals to learn more about the Indigenous peoples in their area or their community or in their state of where they may reside. And so it's learning about within the state of Connecticut, learning about the federally recognized tribes, the state recognized tribes, and the other tribes that were local to Connecticut, and then kind of branching out. And I think, like I said earlier, really learning and understanding that Native people, it's a very diverse group, even here within the United States, and different regions and different culture and different language, and even understanding that there is differences is important. And what you might see in the media or on TV about one tribal nation doesn't necessarily apply to another tribal nation. And so I think learning, starting with the state that you're in, learning a little bit about the history within that context, and then understanding this general kind of overview of Indigenous history and culture and language and the complexity of that, and understanding that is also really important. And you can do that by attending events. There's all kinds of books and literature, I think, out there for people to find, right, in their local library, right? Yes. And figuring out, the different topics, and whether that's, again, history or culture or arts and crafts to politics, policy, literature, right? There, as I said, there's Native people out there all over, and can find different books and contexts. And figuring out, and some of that is, again, you can then either look at national sites that might have different offerings, reading about the different authors and kind of where they're coming from on different perspectives. And so I think it's just kind of, and doing that not only in November, right? November is Native American Heritage Month, or Indigenous Peoples Heritage Month. But to kind of constantly do that and look for opportunities and understand and ask questions and observe, and and if you see something that might not look right, take it upon yourself to also say something as well, and not have just Indigenous peoples to identify different stereotypes that might exist, and but really just to attend events, to understand a general concept, and to continue to learn more. And I think that's the best way to be supportive.
Thank you. And thank you so much again, Dr. Mekomina, for not only your time, but also for your knowledge, your wisdom and insight into not only the history, but also the living narrative of Native American and Indigenous communities.
Okay, thank you.
That's all for this episode of the Hamden Library Podcast. Next month, we'll be back with a special year-end episode featuring staff favorite book and media picks. Thanks for listening.